Radio. This is Democracy Now.
It is time to reverse the decline in defense spending that began in 1985.
President Clinton gives his State of the Union address as his lawyers argue he should not be removed from office. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton delivered his State of the Union address last night in the same House chamber where he was impeached a month ago, and to an audience that included those who voted to impeach him, as well as the judge, prosecutors, and juries in his Senate trial. Clinton proposed to protect Social Security and Medicare with the huge budget surpluses that Republicans are eyeing for tax cuts. He also announced the government will sue the tobacco industry to recover smokers' health costs. Clinton made no mention of the sex and lies case that led to his impeachment. But with the economy booming and the budget balanced, Clinton said America's achievements are sometimes overlooked in the clash of controversy. In just a few minutes, we'll have some response to key points, to his call for an increase in the military and his proposal for the privatization of Social Security. Several Republicans boycotted the 77-minute speech. Chief Justice William Rehnquist, presiding over Clinton's impeachment trial, also stayed away. In a second day before Senate jurors, White House lawyers are challenging contentions by House prosecutors that President Clinton lied to a federal grand jury and obstructed justice. Before the defense resumes its rebuttal today in the historic impeachment trial, each party in the Senate and the prosecution team were to hold separate strategy sessions to prepare for the next step. Senators' written questions, a motion to dismiss the case, and a decision on calling witnesses. White House attorneys will offer a second day of defense in the impeachment trial. And today from London, we have this news on the case of Augusto Pinochet. Hearings have resumed today in Britain's House of Lords on Spain's extradition request of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet to Spain to face charges of genocide and murder. Lawyers for Spain argued yesterday that Chile signed away 11 years ago any rights Pinochet might have had to claim immunity from prosecution abroad for torture. For more on this, we go to London to Reid Brody of Human Rights Watch, who is monitoring the hearings. Reid, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Can you tell us what's happening as we speak?
Well, as you said, the House of Lords is now in their third day of a rehearing on General Pinochet's claim to immunity from arrest as a former head of state. Last November, a panel of the law lords voted 3-2 that he had no such immunity for crimes such as torture, genocide, and hostage taking. That judgment, however, was set aside because one of the judges had links to Amnesty International, which, like Human Rights Watch, is an intervener in the case. So this new panel was set up. This time there are seven judges, all new judges, all, like the previous time, older white males from Cambridge and Oxford. This time, a difference is also that the full Spanish extradition request prepared by Judge Baltazar Garzon is before the court, and Garzon was here these days. And that request goes much further than the arrest warrant that was served on General Pinochet in his hospital, and significantly buttresses the Spanish case by talking about acts that were committed before General Pinochet became head of state, such as the killings and torture that took place on the day of the coup, as well as preparations for the coup that included torture on Chilean naval bases, et cetera.
Reid Brody, I want to thank you very much for being with us. A quick report from Reid Brody of Human Rights Watch in London. We'll keep you updated. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and welcome to the program. Before we move on to the two top stories of the day, the first day of the Senate impeachment trial and the defense of President Clinton by his lead attorney, Charles Ruff, just wanted to keep you updated on an ongoing story we have been covering. This has appeared in the Washington Post today. GOP chairman denounces racist group. Nicholson urges party members to resign from Council of Conservative Citizens. Republican National Committee Chair Jim Nicholson yesterday called on Republicans who are members of the Council of Conservative Citizens to resign from the group, which was founded by leaders of the segregationist White Citizens Council. The Council of Conservative Citizens first gained national attention in December when it was disclosed that Congressmember Bob Barr of Georgia, the Republican member of the House Judiciary Committee, had spoken to the organization at its summer meeting in Charleston. Further news stories revealed that Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott had spoken a number of times to the council and met with the group's Mississippi and national leaders in Washington. Lott recently has renounced the group, and Baum, the head of the group, warned that the majority leader could pay a political price in his home state. He said it could be there'll be a backlash if he keeps it up, if he keeps distancing himself from everything. A sizable segment knows the truth that we're very much in tune with the people of Mississippi on most issues. Baum says his organization is a mainstream conservative group opposed to quotas, forced busing, and other racial policies. Yet the group, as Tom Edsel writes in today's Washington Post, aggressively promotes the controversial views of its leaders. For example, H. Millard, a columnist published by the council's website, wrote that if whites continue to allow heavy immigration and racial mixing, they will become part of a slimy brown mass of glop. We'll keep you updated on that report. Now to, again, some more of today's top stories, and it's the issue of impeachment. And as we said earlier, in a second day before the Senate jurors, White House lawyers are challenging contentions by House prosecutors that President Clinton lied to a federal grand jury and obstructed justice. Before the defense resumes its rebuttal today in the historic impeachment trial, each party in the Senate and the prosecution team are holding separate strategy sessions to prepare for the next step, and that is senators' written questions, a motion to dismiss the case, and a decision of calling witnesses. Today, expected to testify are Greg Craig, attorney for the president, and Cheryl Mills, who also is an attorney at the White House. They will address the issues of obstruction of justice and perjury. Yesterday, the man who opened the defense of President Clinton was his attorney, the White House counsel, Charles Ruff. There were two key moments in the factual defense of President Clinton. One involved the issue of whether President Clinton obstructed justice by telling his secretary, Betty Curry, to call Monica Lewinsky to pick up gifts that he had given her. This had occurred on December 28, 1998, and Ruff said that the House prosecutors had argued that Betty Curry phoned Monica Lewinsky from her cellular phone and arranged a rendezvous in front of the Watergate where Monica Lewinsky lives so that Monica Lewinsky would give Betty Curry the presidential gifts. But what Charles Ruff showed yesterday is that the phone call from Betty Curry's cellular phone occurred actually after Monica Lewinsky gave her the gifts. We go now to Charles Ruff.
At 3:32 p.m. on December 28th, from Arlington, Virginia to Washington, D.C., that's Ms. Lewinsky's number, there was a call of a minute, it says here. And then we have to ask, does this timing fit with the rest of the testimony? Well, the answer is no, it doesn't. Because on three separate occasions, Ms. Lewinsky testified that Ms. Curry came over to pick up the gifts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, an hour and a half before the phone call. Now, it's not as though we've been hiding the ball on this, senators. We discussed this issue at length in our trial brief. And the managers do seem to have recognized at least some of the problem, because they have told you, albeit without the slightest evidentiary support, that maybe Ms. Lewinsky just miscalculated a little bit. Well, maybe she just miscalculated a little bit three times. Look at the record. FBI interview, July 27th. Lewinsky met Curry on 28th Street outside Lewinsky's apartment at about 2 p.m. and gave Curry the box of gifts. FBI interview, August 1st. Lewinsky gave the box to Betty Curry when Curry came by the Watergate about 2 p.m. Grand jury testimony 3 weeks later. I think it was around 2 p.m. or so, around 2 in the afternoon. Now, the managers speculate that if only the independent counsel had had this phone record when they were interviewing Ms. Lewinsky, they could have refreshed her recollection. Now, having been one, I can tell you that's prosecutor speak for if we'd only known about that darn record, we could have gotten her to change her testimony.
White House counsel Charles Ruff, the lead-off testifier in the defense of President Clinton at the second impeachment trial in the history of this republic of a president. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we turn on the telephone now to Professor Stephen Gillers, who teaches at New York University Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor
Thank
Gillers.
Thank you.
What did you think of this first argument saying that President Clinton could not have obstructed justice because the phone call supposedly Betty Curry made to Monica Lewinsky came after she picked up the gifts?
Well, of course, this is only one small part of the obstruction charge, but it was a dramatic moment. And it's the kind of moment that at first blush gives you some feeling of uneasiness about the rest of the case. If they're wrong about this, maybe I shouldn't invest my credibility in the rest of the manager's case. That's what the senators are supposed to think. Now, there are answers, of course, when you look more closely. It may be that Ms. Lewinsky is wrong about the time that Curry picked up the gifts. It may be that the 328 phone call was not the call Curry made to arrange the meeting. Maybe there was an earlier call, and we don't have the record for that. And then, of course, there's a very dramatic fact which Mr. Ruff did not dwell on, and that is that Monica Lewinsky has testified many times that it was Curry who initiated the effort to retrieve the gifts and not she. And Curry, meanwhile, is fuzzy on who initiated the effort. So there is contrary testimony. On the other hand, Ruff, by focusing on this little detail with its logical impossibility, does score points by casting doubt on the rest of the case.
Stephen Gillers, let me play a second argument of the attorney, Charles Ruff, that had to do with obstructing justice, the charge that the House managers made, and that is the issue of December 11th, December 11th, 1997, when Vernon Jordan and President Clinton had a meeting supposedly discussing getting a job for Monica Lewinsky. And the House managers argued that this was the date that they met because it was the day that the Judge Weber Wright, had handed down the decision that she could be called, Monica Lewinsky could be called as a witness in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case. Now, the House manager said that this was clearly obstruction of justice because President Clinton did not want Monica Lewinsky to testify truthfully that she had had an affair with the president. And so what they tried to do basically was quiet her down with a job. But what Charles Ruff showed yesterday was that the meeting that President Clinton and Vernon Jordan had came before they could have known what the judge's decision was. This is Charles Ruff.
Vernon Jordan makes a possible job call at 9:45, another at 12:49, another at 1:07. He meets with Ms. Lewinsky from 1:15 to 1:45. He gets on his plane at 5:55 in the afternoon, and an hour or so later, the lawyers are informed that the judge had issued her order. In fact, just as a little Philip, president's out of town, and returns to Washington on 1:10 a.m. And actually, Judge Wright's order is filed not on the 11th, but on the 12th.
That was Charles Ruff. I said that Vernon Jordan had met with Clinton that day. He met with Monica Lewinsky. But Ruff's argument was he met with her to talk about a job before The judge handed down the decision saying that Monica Lewinsky could be called to testify in Paula Jones's case. How significant is this, Stephen Gibbons?
Well, it's another Perry Mason moment, and it's actually quite an interesting situation to analyze because the House brief put the Judge Wright ruling in the morning, they use the word morning, of December 11, which would enable them to make their argument that that ruling thereby then influenced Jordan's efforts to gear up his job search for Lewinsky. Now, Ruff says, well, look, it didn't happen until the evening, and the Lewinsky-Jordan meeting had already occurred, and Jordan was on a plane to Amsterdam. Question, who's right on the facts? Someone's wrong, and someone is going to have to explain how they made that mistake. But there's another part to this, and that is that even if the House managers are wrong on the facts and the right order came down in the evening so that it could not have influenced Jordan, nevertheless, it is also true that Lewinsky's name first appeared on a witness list 6 days earlier, on December 5th or December 6th, which is when the president learned of her name on the list. Now, therefore, it is clear that there was a motive in Jordan and the president to increase their efforts to get Lewinsky a job before December 11. The motive may not have been Judge Wright's order, which they might have anticipated, but rather the appearance of Lewinsky's name on a witness list, which signaled to the president for the first time, most dramatically, that Jones's lawyers knew about Lewinsky. And so the interesting lawyering aspect here is that the House managers relied on a fact, which may not be a fact, because it may be that Judge Wright ruled at night, not in the morning, when they didn't have to rely on that fact, because there was an earlier fact, the December 5th witness list, that they could have used to make their same point. But because they relied on a fact that they might have gotten wrong, Ruff was able to exploit that error and get us to feel uneasy again about the entire prosecution case.
Of course, there's another issue, and that is, why are all these powerful people, from President Clinton to Vernon Jordan to Betty Curry, involved with getting a young woman who is an intern in the White House a job?
Oh, absolutely so. And not only that, Ambassador Richardson even meets with her. When does an ambassador to the UN meet with a recent college graduate about a low-level job? So there are background facts, contextual facts, which make Ruff's argument about coincidence harder to credit. And, of course, he largely avoided that. And the House managers argued in their presentation that the president would indeed seek to isolate each incident and argue coincidence, but that the Senate should look at the entire picture and see if globally it meshes with a claim of innocence.
Professor Gillers, overall, since we just have a minute, how do you think Charles Ruff did yesterday as he opened the defense of President Clinton?
I think he did extremely well. I don't think anyone could have done better. Now, that doesn't mean that his argument won't be chipped away at in the days to come, but his affect, his tone, his irony and sarcasm on occasion, his respect for the Senate, and his meticulous marshaling of the information to cast doubt on the credibility of the prosecution case were all exemplary.
Hmm. Finally, do you think it's too cynical to say, well, this man, Charles Ruff, has a great deal of experience in dealing with people or entities accused of perjury? After all, he got his start as one of the leading lawyers in this country, part of the blue-chip law firm in Washington, Covington Burling, fighting the Rose Cipollone family, the woman who died of lung cancer years ago, one of the first cases brought against the tobacco industry. She died of lung cancer. She brought this case just before she died. Her family carried it on to hold the tobacco companies responsible. Covington and Burling represents the Tobacco Institute, which represents the tobacco industries, and Charles Ruff was very effective in wiping out that family.
Well, you know, if we're going to be fair, we also have to point out that he had a major role in the Abscam prosecutions a generation ago. I'm not inclined to saddle trial lawyers with the sins of their clients ordinarily. Lawyers are hired to make arguments. Ruff is an exceptionally good trial lawyer, and He showed it yesterday.
And we will continue to bring our listeners what the attorneys for the president bring to his case as they defend him again today. Greg Craig and Cheryl Mills will argue for the president. Tomorrow it will be David Kendall. Steve Gillers, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor of Law at New York University Law School. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at what President Clinton proposed last night in his State of the Union address. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
Unfortunately, President Clinton will not rise to the extraordinary challenge of reducing Pentagon spending and the influence of the military-industrial complex. He will choose the safe political path and initiate a bidding war with the Republicans and engage the United States in a new arms race. This time, we are engaged in a vigorous arms race with ourselves.
And that was Pete DeFazio, the Oregon Congress member, who is part of the Progressive Caucus, responding to President Clinton, his proposal for a $110 billion increase in the military. Last night, he repeated his call for an expanded military.
It is time to reverse the decline in defense spending that began in 1985. Since April, together we have added nearly $6 billion to maintain our military readiness. My balanced budget calls for a sustained increase over the next 6 years for readiness, for modernization, and for pay and benefits for our troops and their families.
Again, that is President Clinton in his State of the Union address last night. And before that address, the Progressive Caucus gave its alternative State of the Union address, addressing a number of different issues, the military spending issue being a major one. California Congress member Barbara Lee, who replaced Ron Dellums, also addressed this issue.
I encourage the administration to reconsider the proposal to expand military funding for machinery and hardware and instead continue and begin to look at some of the progress that has been made toward greater disarmament and peacekeeping. So it's in the context of the budget priorities that we need to focus and look at income and wealth disparity. As we heard earlier, wealth is concentrated in the top 5% of American households. So while some are living in luxury, others are working longer and longer at wages adjusted for inflation. Really haven't changed since the 1970s. So income inequality and wage equality, moving toward wage equality, really is something that I hope the president will focus on.
Another issue that President Clinton addressed last night was Social Security.
By 2032, the trust fund will be exhausted, and Social Security will be unable to pay the full benefits older Americans have been promised. The best way to keep Social Security a rock-solid guarantee is not to make drastic cuts in benefits, not to raise payroll tax rates, not to drain resources from Social Security in the name of saving it. Instead, I propose that we make the historic decision to invest the surplus to save Social Security.
the path the White House has laid out to preserve Social Security for the next half century would bring about the most fundamental change in the program's history by hinging some of the nation's retirement system on the earning power of the stock market for the first time. Today, to discuss and debate this issue, we are joined by two people. Michael Tanner, director of the Health and Welfare Studies at the Cato Institute, and Doug Henwood, writer for the Left Business Observer and author of the book Wall Street. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Doug Henwood. Doug, can you first lay out the president's proposal and then how you feel about it?
Well, the president proposes putting 20% of the surplus funds that he's planning to invest to save Social Security into the stock market. It would result in something like $50 or $70 billion a year going into the market, and by the next 15 years or so, the government would end up owning about 4 or 5% of all the stock in the country. My first problem with this is that the universal assumption that Social Security is going broke is it's a phony crisis. These are based on projections of economic growth of just 1.4% a year over the next 75 years, which is about half the historical average. And there's a whole host of preposterous assumptions which the trustees of the system use to arrive at these numbers. But the bottom line is that if we have even slow, not even historically normal, economic growth over the next 75 years, the system doesn't go bankrupt. So all this talk of crisis and insolvency is an invention of statisticians with quite possibly a political agenda of privatization.
Michael Tanner, what are your thoughts on the privatization of Social Security, investing the retirement funds of people around this country in the stock market?
Well, I think that the way the president is going about it is a pretty terrible idea. The president would make the federal government a major shareholder, a major owner of virtually every American corporation. And I think that represents a fundamental change in the way this country has run for 200 and some odd years. On the other hand, I have to say that there certainly is a Social Security crisis. And in addition to the financial crisis, and we can debate the assumptions behind that, but there's a more immediate crisis, and that is that Social Security has become a lousy deal for most young Americans. Most young workers are actually going to receive a negative rate of return from Social Security. That is, they'll pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits, lose money in the system. And that's not a crisis that's 15 or 30 years away. That's a crisis that's occurring today. And only by moving into a system based on saving and investment can we bring up that rate of return and ensure better retirements and more secure retirements for young workers.
Doug Henwood.
Well, I think this application of financial logic to Social Security is really inaccurate. First of all these ideas that young workers are getting a negative rate of return, all these kinds of projections are based very sensitive to the kinds of assumptions that these projections are based on. What it is fundamentally is a deal across the generations. That is, today's workers support today's retirees on the assumption that today's workers who become tomorrow's retirees will get the same kind of treatment in the future. And the deal is that it will give you a decent check. About 42% of the elderly population is kept out of poverty because of Social Security benefits. And the application of this kind of financial reasoning to what is a universal, solidaristic insurance scheme, I think, is completely inappropriate.
Doug Henwood, we have to break for one. Doug, we have to break for 1 minute, but we're going to come back to you in a second. Doug Henwood and Michael Tanner talking about Social Security. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
We'll be right back.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Doug Henwood of the Left Business Observer, author of the book Wall Street, and Michael Tanner, director of health and welfare studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Doug Henwood, you were just responding to Michael Tanner's point of this being an overall loss for young workers who have to put more out for Social Security than they'll ever get back.
Yeah, I think this is part also of an attempt to undermine the system's credibility with young people. And the polls that show a considerable degree of skepticism that they'll ever get a benefit for Generation X folks usually fail to report the fact that they want it to be there. They just assume it's not going to be. And I'm arguing that there's no economic reason why it can't be. The main reason is political. So maybe there is a truth to the idea that it won't be there in the future because people like Bill Clinton and Michael Tanner have decided that it shouldn't be. But there is absolutely no economic reason. I can't emphasize this enough. There is no on any kind of reasonable economic projections, there's no reason why Social Security can't continue for the next 75 years with no more than minor changes.
Michael Tanner, do you see it continuing as it is?
Well, yes, and I'll go into that for a minute. The fact is that even if it continued as it is, it would be a bad deal. Continuing as it is means a negative rate of return. In fact, if we paid all the benefits, if there was no shortfall at all in Social Security and 100% of the benefits could be paid into the future, average young workers would still earn a negative rate of return on the system, getting back less in benefits than they pay in taxes over the course of their life. But the problem is we're not going to be able to continue to pay all the benefits. It's not a matter of total GDP growth. Social Security is based on two factors, the size of the workforce and the growth in real wages. And the fact is our workforce is shrinking. If it were not for immigration, in fact, we'd actually have a negative growth in the workforce. And immigration will only keep our workforce pretty much the same for another 10 or 15 years, after which our workforce will begin to contract. At the same time, real wages are essentially flat. They've actually declined slightly in the last 20 years. Given those two factors, as it continues, and the declining ratio of workers supporting each retiree, there is no way that this program can continue into the future.
Doug Henwood, is there no way?
There is every way. I think I've really taken apart all these projections in the trustees' report, so I know them very well. The notion that there's a smaller percentage of the population that's going to be working in the future is a very partial truth. There are going to be a lot more older people, but there are a lot fewer younger people. Additionally, over the last 50 to 100 years, the trend has been for more and more people to enter the paid labor market. We've had people coming off the farms. We've had women coming out of housework, all into the paid labor market. And the result is that we have many fewer non-workers per worker than we did 50 or 100 years ago. Even if you accept the official projections for 2050 or 2075 that the Social Security people are laying out, we'd have a larger portion of the population working for pay in a distant future than we did as recently as 1970 or 1950. So if we could afford Social Security then, we could afford it in the future. These are very devious sets of projections, and if you rerun the numbers with reasonable economic growth projections, and I'm allowing for stagnation in real wages and everything else, if you just assume a slightly higher increase in the wage pool because of slightly higher economic growth, the crisis disappears. And I'd like to see somebody refute these numbers that's actually familiar with them rather than just reciting a mantra that they picked up from focus groups.
Michael Tanner, are you concerned at all about people getting older and not having the safety net that they need, that Social Security has provided, the unpredictability of the stock market, even if it is, I don't know what the term is, bullish now?
Well, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why I want to privatize the Social Security system, is to provide a better safety net. The fact is that market over long-term investment is a remarkably safe place to put your money. Well, there's never even been a 20-year period in U.S. history in which you would have lost money in the market, let alone the 45-year period that would stretch over the average worker's lifetime. In fact, since the beginning of stock markets in the U.S., the average rate of return has been about 7.5% a year. So if we're allowing people to invest over that long a period of time, the market is remarkably safe. And all the proposals for Social Security privatization on Capitol Hill include a safety net provision, which ensures that in the unlikely event that something went wrong and some individual did not have enough in their account to guarantee a safe retirement, that there would be provisions made to provide for that person.
If this safety net is anything like the Chilean model, which is everybody's model, including Cato's, that safety net would be about a dollar or two a day. So that's a pretty porous net.
Well, that safety net in Chile is based on 80% of the minimum wage, which is about 10% higher than the minimum Social Security benefit under the old Social Security system in Chile. So it is actually a more generous safety net in Chile than they had previously, and we would propose a more generous safety net under the than is offered by the current Social Security system here.
I'm curious why the Chilean army and police kept their old public system rather than going at the private system, but let's talk about the United States. The stock market does perform impressive average returns over a very long period of time, 6% if you go back to 1870, 7.5% depending upon where you draw the starting line. But that is an average of very volatile highs and lows. If you're unlucky enough to retire during the depths of a bear market, you're going to have a very different kind of retirement than you would if you're lucky enough to retire today after a long bull market. The range in this century is from about 3% over the very long term, if we're talking about a 30 or 40-year period, from about 3% to about 9%. That makes, if you compound it over time, that makes a nine-fold difference in your retirement portfolio. So you could end up with $100,000 in retirement or $1 million in retirement, just depending on what time of the economic cycle you're retiring during. And that's even if you have the same saving behavior. If you put away the same amount every month, you can have a nine-fold difference over the course of a simulated lifetime.
I agree with you on that. But the question
I also don't understand how you can have 7% returns in the stock market when the economy is growing 1.4% a year. That's a prescription for price earnings ratios in the hundreds in just a couple of decades. And what we're asking to have the stock market expand to a tremendous bubble if we're going to have such tremendously weak economic growth as everyone seems to forecast who are partisans of Social Security's bankruptcy.
Well, two points on that. First, in response to why Chile's army and police stayed out, the question would be why 5 million state employees in the U.S. stay out of Social Security if Social Security is such a good deal. The second part of that, though, is that people would receive varying degrees of retirement benefits depending on how the market does, and it does range from 3% on up. The question isn't whether or not we want everyone to have equal benefits. It's we want everyone to have better benefits. And 3% would be better than zero or negative, which is what they'll receive under the current system. Even if Social Security paid all its current benefits, if you accept all of your assumptions and say that Social Security is solvent indefinitely into the future and just take the benefits that are projected against the payroll taxes that are projected under the current system, they're going to receive zero or negative rate of return. A 3% rate of return is better than that.
You know, before we break, I actually wanted to go back to the Chilean model that you talked about, but address it in another way. I understand that the head of Social Security at Cato Institute is Jose Pineda. Is that right?
No, I am the head of the Social Security program at Cato Institute.
And Mr. Pineda, what is his role at the Cato Institute?
Mr. Pineda is the co-chairman of a consulting board of international experts on the subject.
But connected to the Cato Institute.
The board is the advisory board to the Cato Project.
I also understand he is the former finance minister of Pinochet, is down in Chile right now.
He was the Social Security and Labor Minister in the Chilean government under Pinochet.
Uh-huh. Are you at all concerned that someone might call for his arrest and extradition?
If he's committed any crimes, then he should be tried. As far as I know, his position was an economic one. He was not involved in any of the police decisions. Down there, and that's a legal matter. I'm taking his economic expertise, not dealing with him on other issues.
It is interesting to note that the Cato Institute is abiding by the recommendations of this former finance minister for Pinochet, which shows you something about the structure of a government that it wants to recommend to the United States.
Well, I would also suggest that this privatized Social Security proposal has been recently enacted in Mexico, in El Salvador, where the Salvadoran guerrillas now in the government voted in favor of it, as well as in Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, Bolivia, Uruguay, Argentina, most of Eastern Europe, Britain, Australia, where it's implemented by a Labor government, and even in communist China. So it is hardly endemic to South American dictatorships.
Finally, Doug Henwood. I'll let you
I would note that most of those countries that were listed are not exactly paragons of democracy. The British system is interesting. The Wall Street Journal had a very interesting front-page story about that a few months ago, talking about tremendous disaster, fraud, churning of accounts, all kinds of missed promises. People who expected a cornucopia of wealth out of their privatized retirement accounts, as were promised during the Thatcher years, have found a very, very different situation, something that's expensive and nowhere near as munificent a source of wealth as the privatizers' song would indicate.
Doug Henwood and Michael Tanner, we have to wrap up. Doug Henwood, phone number for the Left Business Observer, and Michael Tanner will get your coordinates as well.
212-874-4020, or you can go to Yahoo and search for Left Business Observer and find us on the web, too.
That's 212-874-4020. Michael Tanner, Cato Institute.
You can reach our Social Security site at www.socialsecurity.org, or you can call us at 202-842-0200.
That's 202-842-0200. Thank you very much, Michael Tanner of Cato Institute, Doug Henwood of Left Business Observer, and
Thank
author
you.
Of Wall Street. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, President Clinton addressed the issue of welfare as well. We'll hear what he had to say and get response. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
And loneliness.
Here's some good news. In the past 6 years, we have cut the welfare rolls nearly in half. Years ago from this podium, I asked five companies to lead a national effort to hire people off welfare. Tonight, our welfare-to-work partnership includes 10,000 companies who have hired hundreds of thousands of people, and our balanced budget will help another 200,000 people move to the dignity and pride of work. I hope you will support it.
And that was President Clinton yesterday, last night, actually, at the State of the Union address. President Clinton is proposing a $1 billion welfare initiative to help the nation's most disadvantaged families move from welfare to work. The proposal has a familiar ring. Congress authorized a similar program for 1998 and 1999. But because most states have large surpluses in their welfare accounts, Congress may be reluctant to pass more funds their way. The same time, Clinton's effort to target the $1 billion to help the fathers of children on welfare so they can pay child support and reconnect with their children's lives lives are popular on both sides of the aisle. Republicans last year proposed a $2 billion plan to help such fathers and announced plans to introduce it. Right now, we're going to go to Wisconsin. We're joined on the telephone by Gwendolyn Moore. Gwendolyn Moore, who is a Wisconsin state senator. She was a mother on welfare herself for a year. And she has championed poor people's rights since her election to the Wisconsin State Senate in 1992. She is Wisconsin's first African-American woman state senator. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, State Senator Moore. Good morning. Well, why don't you tell us, since you're in the state that is really the national model for workfare, as you call it, W-2, how the program works there. Tommy Thompson has been hailed by President Clinton and by governors around the country for this program.
Well, we deal with the same sort of theater that that they deal with in Washington and elsewhere around the country. The overwhelming, thunderous applause that the president received when he mentioned that half the people were off welfare. I guess those are the that's the applause that sort of drowns out the tears of the people who are being thrown off welfare at this point. I listened with rapt attention when the president talked about the 50% of the folk leaving welfare and the 10,000 companies who stepped up to the plate to employ these people. And what it brings to mind is the caseload that we're experiencing here in Wisconsin. At this point, the only people who are left on welfare in Wisconsin are women of color. 85% of them are African-American, Hispanics, or Hmong women on welfare. Less than 10% of the folk who are still on welfare are non-African-American, non-Hispanic, or women of color. Also, the folk left on welfare here have no high school equivalencies, no high school diplomas, obviously, have reading levels below the fifth grade reading level, even lower math skills, and they are unable to access child care. I heard you talk earlier, leading into this discussion, about the huge surpluses that are being left in state budgets for welfare, and that's because people cannot really access the child care. Here in Wisconsin, we have child care co-payments so that, let me give you an example, a mom who is trying to work herself out of poverty earns at the poverty level, 100% of the poverty level, and with three kids will find herself making a co-payment of something like $140 a month. Co-payment for child care. And this, so what we're experiencing in Wisconsin is that moms are leaving their older children at home to babysit for younger children, and those older children are not attending school. We're finding teen parents who are being counseled to drop out of school so as to enhance the numbers of folk who are in the workforce. And so all is not well behind those numbers, as we've experienced it here in Wisconsin. Homeless shelters are bursting at the seams. Our local area churches are doubling up as emergency shelter sites. Wisconsin has one of the best food pantry distribution systems in the country, and we're being inundated by requests of folk who are not just using the food pantries for, an occasional emergency, but are now using it as a matter of daily bread. So our experience here in Wisconsin is, we've experienced more reduction in caseloads than anyone else, and we've also experienced more homelessness, more hunger, more desperation. People are starting to commit petty crimes in order to eat. We're finding that we have $71 million left in our child care pot because our co-payment structure is too high. And we've left on the welfare rolls people that employers are not going to hire. We did a survey of our employers in the area, and they've indicated that they want people to have at least eighth grade reading skills, at least eighth grade math skills. And obviously, the folk who are left on welfare don't even come close to that.
We're talking to Gwendolyn Moore, who is Wisconsin State Senator, who's had experience with welfare herself, now represents particularly the poor in the Wisconsin State Legislature. Now, is it true that there was a conference call to the White House last night that you were a part of on the issue of welfare and workfare?
I was not able to patch into that conference call.
What was the point of it?
That's a good question. Since I didn't make it. I don't know what they would have said. But had I been on that conference call, I would have indicated that if the president is going to pump more money into welfare, or change the legislation at all, he ought to provide more educational opportunities under the bill. Because people, I don't care how much money they put into work, how many subsidies they give corporations, how many tax credits they give corporations, as long as we're left with a former AFTC population that's uneducated, employers are not going to be able to use them in a productive way. I think when we look at the history of economic systems in the world, we have found that one of the limitations of, say, a communistic system, for example, is its feeble effort to put people to work who are not necessarily skilled, to just simply have people fully employed for the sake of saying that they're fully employed. So at this point, the caseloads in Wisconsin, and I suspect elsewhere in the country, it is impossible to reduce them any further without an aggressive literacy program, an aggressive program to try to get people high school equivalencies, and some technological skills. Otherwise, it's just rhetoric to say, you know, this thunderous applause that we've gotten 50%, we've cut the welfare rolls at 50%. What victory is there if we've kicked them off welfare and sent them to the homeless shelter?
Let me ask you this. There was a study last week that was publicized about the W-2 program, the workfare program in Wisconsin. How it was played in most of the corporate media was that it is a tremendous success. What was your response to it?
Well, that was the AFTC Leavers report. Number one, they only... there were 35,000 people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who had left the AFDC roles, and the sample had only 500 folk in it. Of these 500 folk, all of these folk were folk who left welfare last September and had continued to work. They only interviewed those who had who were working in September of 1988 and had continued to work for 9 months. So in other words, they interviewed the quote-unquote cream of the crop, those folks that we've always known in welfare culture who were the easiest to hire. Those were the folks who used welfare temporarily. They were always on and off. And they used welfare like a sort of unemployment compensation insurance. Those folk who were reporting were, first of all, not the hardcore AFTC recipient that is hard to move to work. That's number one. Number two, even though they were the cream of the crop, those statistics were woefully distressing, considering that they were the cream of the crop. 68% of them were working, which means that 32% of them, that there was a 32%, I'm sorry, 62% of them were working. 38% of them were unemployed.
It's also interesting to point out that it was a phone survey, and you're talking about the poorest of the poor now surveyed
the
by
poorest
phone.
Of the poor. So you had to have a phone, first of all. And literally 50% of the folk who are on welfare now have no phone, have no driver's license, no ability to get a driver's license because they can't read. So there was a 38% unemployment rate. Of those who were employed, 62% of them said that they were barely making it. Most of them talked about barriers such as access to child care, access to transportation as being major barriers toward their getting some employment. So now all of the white women have left welfare. All the women who possibly, it's interesting, in this Leavers report, they did not indicate what the educational attainment levels were of the folk that they interviewed. But I suspect that those folk who had GEDs or high school diplomas that were very close to having those credentials versus the caseload that is currently left on welfare. We've had some of the caseworkers who are working with this population who've called us in the meetings within the last couple of weeks and said, Senator Moore, please help. We have now hit that part of the caseload where we cannot move them off anymore. So these 10,000 employers, this huge initiative that President Clinton is going to take to encourage more employers to participate in hiring welfare recipients. He had better send some hard, cold cash for extensive literacy training and education along with them.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Senator Moore, for being with us
today. And thank you, too. And, good day to everybody out there in the Beltway.
And good day to you, too, Wisconsin State Senator Gwendolyn Moore. And today we're going to go out with alternative State of the Union address, an excerpt of it, from South Carolina Congressmember Earl Hilliard, one of the leaders of the Progressive Caucus.
America is the richest nation on earth. We are in the midst of the greatest, in the middle of the greatest and longest economic expansion in our history. And yet, in the midst of all of this, poverty fester like cancer, like a sore. Indeed, it is not too late. It is too late for this century, but it is not too late for the next millennium for America to change and to become proactive in looking after those who are less fortunate. Sure, we have our sprawling suburbia communities where the rich, the very rich, and the affluent middle class live. But we also have Appalachia. We also have the Mississippi Delta. We also have the Black Belt of the southern states like Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. But more than that, we have in the Southwest pathetic and pitiful Indian reservations. And most importantly, in our western, northern, and southern cities, we have large urban centers, huge area of poverty. It is said that a nation is measured by the level of its civilization, and that is measured by how that civilization treats its unfortunate, the young, the poor, the elderly, and those who are unable to fend for themselves. If that is truly the yardstick.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, South Carolina Congressmember Earl Hilliard, excerpt of an alternative State of the Union address he gave yesterday with other members of the Congressional Black Caucus. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order one from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Joe Gill engineered our show from WPFW. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Jeremy Scahill, Dan Coughlin, and Mark Beavis. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WPFW in Washington. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!